This week on the show, the New York Times erects a paywall. ICANN says yes, yes, yes to the XXX domain. And an author says no to $500,000. You don't need no stinking publisher. Right here on This Week in Media, number 226. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex Lindsay. And coming in from Connecticut, we've got Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon.
Hey, how are you, Alex?
I'm doing well. And back from South by Southwest, Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
How you feeling, Tim?
One of our listeners hooked me up with a special VIP pass to the CNN Grill. And that was a treat. They took over a restaurant in Austin, and they actually put up signage, big CNN sign, neon sign, rotating sign. I mean, it wasn't a cheap ordeal.
They took over the restaurant
and totally branded it. They built stages inside the restaurant.
Holy smokes.
And I got to watch some bands and eat free food and free drink, and the price was right on everything. And they had to kick me out of the place. I didn't want to leave.
they did that during the Democratic convention in Colorado also.
They must have all the stuff now in storage. You know, all the signs and the rotating signs and the stages. They just come with a truck. It's the instant CNN restaurant.
It's a pop up CNN grill.
Now, what were the big things that you saw at South by Southwest that are related to media?
The biggest thing was the pop up Apple Store.
That was crazy.
I was walking to the convention center from my my lovely extended stay hotel, motel, whatever, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning. I walked by, and there's five people in line at a building that has no signage at all.
Talk about being on a road to nowhere.
Yeah, and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to hang out here. And so I grabbed a coffee and a sandwich and just kind of waited in line, and then I started having people come meet me and do my meetings while I stood in line. And I'm like, I'm just going to stand here until something better happens. And then, you know, it slowly came out that it was the Apple Store and that, you know. And then one of the guys in line bought us all lunch. And later we found out he worked for Apple. But, you know, we all had sandwiches and Cokes and chips. And it was just fun hanging out in line. And then my friends would come by and you know, talk. And then I'd have a meeting or something, or there were other people in line that I wanted to meet with, and they would come up, and I was sixth person, so that was kind of like, for most of the day, that was where the PR stopped. Like, they would interview the first five people, and then they wouldn't, but then all of a sudden, our buddy Brian Brushwood shows up, and he like spots me, and so then that was it, you know. Cat was out of the bag. All of a sudden I started getting interviewed by everyone and made it on CNN. And awesome. It was a fun day.
Did you get an iPad?
I got two iPads, one for the home office at MDialog, and one for me to use while I'm out, you know, telling people about MDialog. So it was good.
That's awesome.
And yeah, they are fun.
It is. It is a little media machine. You know, it really just changed. My son can literally sit on his iPad for, not sit on it, but like sit using it for 5 or 6 hours straight, which if I don't take it away. And then when I take it away, there's a tantrum, you know, on the other end of that, you know. And
I'm the same way. Don't take mine. You got a problem.
I've learned to charge his iPad, but not charge it all the way. You know, giving him like a 20%, I just keep it kind of toned up at 20% because eventually it will die. If I do it all the way, because then he'll just walk up to me and he'll understand that I didn't take it away. It just died. And now it needs to be recharged. And he'll just come and say it needs to be recharged. And there's no fuss, no muss. But if I charge it all the way, he'll be up until 2 o'clock in the morning working on that thing. And yeah, and he is remarkably good at it. I mean, at 3 years old, it's quite an amazing thing to watch. And my daughter now, if she sees it, she demands it. She just demands that she has it. She's only 20 months. Yeah, so it's,
wow.
It's kind of
something about those things that kids are just totally attracted to. It's amazing. Just
being able to touch it.
Young,
I mean, just totally, you know, the fact that we've gotten rid of the keyboard just totally takes away this disconnection that I'm very comfortable with. But kids just immediately, oh, I understand this. I just click this and move this, and it all works. You know. So anyway, it's very interesting. Speaking of media and our iPads, this is coming in from the New York Times, and this is the New York Times talking about the New York Times. Here is the New York Times is going to start charging for media. Now, they've been talking about this for a while, and Rupert Murdoch says that everyone should pay for something. Now, the New York Times really took his stuff that he's been talking about to heart and really ran with it. Okay, so here's the upshot. You can look at up to, it's a little complex. I'm going to try to talk about it slowly to make sure you understand all the details here. Up to 20 articles a month are free. So if you only go once every weekday, you're pretty much going to, you know, get an art, you know, and just get one article on the New York Times. You won't ever feel this. It'll just be free if you're just a casual user. You can get up to five a day. So this is 20 articles a month. Five a day if you're clicking via Google, Facebook, Twitter. So if someone puts up a Twitter link and you click on it, if you come that direction, now you can do up to five a day. So the key is to Twitter something and then click on it. Like it's kind of confusing. Anyway, now if you don't want to deal with any of that and you just want to pay for it and have access to it, for $195 a year, you can have web and mobile. There's a mobile app and web access, so you can look at as much as you want on the web. For $260 a year, there's an iPad app that you can you view everything through. And for $455 a month, doesn't matter what you use. You can use web, you can use mobile, you can use iPad. For the cheap price of $455 a year. Now, this is compared to, I think it was $15 a year for the daily. But of course, the New York Times is much deeper than the daily. There's a lot more. There's just a more content in it than a day-to-day piece. There's a lot of people there. There's a lot of things there. They're trying to figure out a way to support it. The bottom line is that they haven't been able to make enough money on the web to replace the costs, to make it work. So they're looking at charging people. So, Tim, is this going to work? Is this paywall going to work?
Well, it does seem to be that there's some kind of discrimination here. So if you're social media savvy, you can probably get by with your five articles a day, right? But if you're not, you're going to have to pay. It really boils down to, do they have the content that people want?
And the original content, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and are they going to be able to police it when people are somehow scraping that content and making it available in other places? I mean, do you guys know off the top of your head what a home delivery subscription costs of the New York Times?
You know, I don't.
Wife signed up for a Sunday New York Times at a local fair. It was it's not inexpensive. I mean, I think it's $50 per whatever. She paid a good amount of money for it, and the paper didn't even show up this Sunday. So
wow.
How good is that?
Yeah, what's funny is I stopped getting papers mostly because I just don't like dealing with – it's not even the money. I just don't like dealing with the paper.
Yeah, afterwards, right?
You know,
yep.
It was always like, oh, I got to figure out what to do with it. And so then we just stack up. And when I grew up, we had a fireplace. And so that's where the paper was used to start all the fires. And so it was all like, you know.
Circle of life kind of stuff.
Circle of life. You've been watching Rango, haven't you? Anyway, I just didn't like dealing with the actual hardware of it. But now here at Lawn, is it too much? Is this gonna create a barrier that starts pushing people to other people? Because the issue is that for me, I look at this like I really like going to the New York Times. There's a lot of things we link a lot of things from the New York Times. I'm tempted because we use it a lot for This Week in Media. I mean, we find a lot of New York Times articles in our article. There's a bunch of them in this case that we might get it for the company. But I'm not sure as a person whether I wouldn't just go to CNN or go to other outlets. Is this going to be too much? Is it going to push people away from the New York Times?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's free right now. I could see. Even $20 a month for the iPad version, $21 a month, is a lot of money for one news source. And I don't think that's how people consume media anymore. It's multiple sources. And although the Times does tremendous in-depth work, you can almost get that same level of depth by reading two or three or four different sources on the same story as well. I'm also thinking about how much work is going to go into the getting around these restrictions. You know that there'll be a browser plugin on day one that will circumvent the 20 articles a month for free thing. Oh,
and I'm wondering if it'll block it the same way. So I'm going to ruin my one of my favorite bypasses for a paywall on the show, because I know that there's people at this magazine that listen to our show. So I know this is the end of my enjoying Variety for free. But so Variety, you know, Variety.com is a paywall. And if you haven't subscribed, you get this big black, you know, it shows you the article for like a second, like 5 seconds, and then it blacks it over and says, you know, you need to subscribe to the Variety. Of course, if you hit reader on your in Safari, it then just shows you the whole article. So now, and that'll work for the next week. And then
right.
They might have to have a meeting or two about it first.
So maybe I'll get a month out of that. Maybe I'll get a month out of reading the Variety for free.
Yeah, a little bit left before they kill it.
But right. I've been enjoying it for 6 months. So, you know, it's just kind of like, you know, so I guess it's time for me to, move on. So anyway, but the point is that people are going to be trying to work around this. Does the New York Times risk losing both print and web? I mean, print is dying. You know, as far as a newspaper, I mean, we're 10 years from now, we're not going to be getting newspapers. And it just the problem is, it's just not going to be sustainable. People say, well, there's still going to be people out there wanting their newspaper, and they're going to want to own it. But the problem is that it doesn't have to drop to 0% of the people who are using it now. It only has to drop by 30 or 40% before it just doesn't become sustainable anymore. So the thing is that suddenly you just can't afford to print them. It doesn't matter whether there's a lot of people who still want it. It just, you lose that mass, the critical mass that's required to actually get it out the door. So if print is going away and they make this too much, do they risk losing it all?
Well, you know, you take a look at the train industry, right? They thought they were train people. They didn't realize that they were in the transportation business.
Right.
And when the airline industry came along, they just were like, well, those are airplanes, we're trains. And, you know, the companies that realize that they're in the news business, not the newspaper business, you know, they'll adapt, they'll survive, and things will move on. So it really boils down to that. You know, will there be a freight train business in the future? Yeah, probably. Will there be print? I imagine on a small scale there will, but it's not going to be the way that the majority of people consume their news.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just looking at this too, thinking this is really the digital subscribers propping up the print version, because that's where they're losing their money. It's just so much infrastructure to support.
Well, the argument is, and it's hard to, there's a lot of infrastructure to support, but I think that the argument really is that what creates the content, you know, for a lot of this is an enormous number of people that are doing research, checking the research. I mean, one of the things, you know, when you go to the New York Times or The Economist or, you know, many other of these big publications, is that the article that you're reading has been read by 3 or 4 people to make sure that the facts are correct, to make sure that the spelling is correct, to make sure that, you know, all those pieces are kind of put together to make sure that you're getting, you know, something that is, you know, accurate. It's not always that it always is, but there's a lot of work that goes into that. And it's the people resources of creating that content that creates the seamless experience that we have when we go to that content. Not so much, I mean, because while there's a lot of infrastructure for the print, I think the print is still making money. You know, like the if you take out the staff that creates the content, I think the print is actually still making money. But the you know, just as far as we sell you a paper that has a certain number of ads in it, and that's paid for, you know, through that process. But it is one of those things that it's that massive infrastructure that companies like the New York Times have that A, makes their content really good, but B, also makes it really expensive. You know, I think that's the challenge. Now, here's the question for you, Lon. If this doesn't work, will people come back? I mean, once they lose them, are people going to lose them forever? I mean, we get into patterns. We start to go down a pattern of we go to the same sites every day. Will people get out of the pattern because the New York Times has got a paywall?
I don't think so. I think content has become such a commodity now that you'll go where it is. And if there's something that interests you, I mean, most of the content that I discover is through my Twitter feed or my Google Reader or something along those lines where I'm linking in. I think there won't be much of a – there's not a lot of risk here for them. I mean, they'll make some money
almost,
in the short term.
In some ways, it's better to shoot high and make sure that you get as much as you can. And if it doesn't work, you can always pull back a little bit.
Right. Or they can dial it back a little bit or up the monthly article limit. I think there's a lot of things that they – that they'll do to try to adjust this over time. Because I just looking at first glance, you know, the amount of access charges here is pretty substantial.
Yeah.
It's great content. It's worth the money. But is it worth it for me, you know, with a dozen subscriptions already? You know, I'd almost want to see a Hulu type of news content site where I can get multiple sources for the same money and they can figure out how to distribute it. I don't know if that's a better way to do it. But you know what? Let them try it. Yeah. Let's see what happens.
Well, right? It'll be interesting. We'll definitely be covering this over the next weeks and months as it kind of unfolds. Now, speaking of something that we've been covering for weeks and months and years, I think we've been talking about this almost since TWIM began, because this has been a long-term fight. And that is that ICANN has now finally allowed the .xxx suffix to be used. So this has been something that, interestingly enough, has been opposed by both sides. So you have one group that's trying to push it through, but you know, according to Diane Duke, the executive director of the Free Speech Coalition, said our industry is unanimously opposed. Now, this is a trade organization representing more than 1,000 pornography businesses, but on the other side of that, the .xxx registry is also opposed by some religious groups. This is according to the New York Times, who feared that the new domain would lead to more the further spread of pornography on the internet, like it could spread any further. the one person that is behind it is Mr. Lawley, who says tens of thousands of businesses have already reserved some 200,000 .xxx domains. Each registration costs $60 a year, so he is making bank. So he definitely is. It's turned out okay for him. This is the person who has been actually managing this, and I think that's been a big piece of that. So Tim, who wins? The religious right or the porn industry?
I want to know what happens when you go to Disney.xxx. What are you going to get? Where's it going to redirect, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like, wow. I don't know. I really am. I feel uneducated about this one, because I can see it going many different ways. I mean, I understand religious organizations being against this because it's just another, in their eyes, shouldn't be there at all.
Well, and their concern is that it validates it. You know, they want it to be something that is, you know,
it should be pushed down. It should be. I mean, it's interesting that in this article or these notes, we talk about the word pornography, and like, pornography is illegal. So how can these be pornographic? I mean, they're adult websites versus pornography. You know, there's like that legal distinction between what is legal and what is illegal.
I think pornography is legal itself. It's just that it depends on
well,
you're able to restrict it. You're able to restrict it once you've decided if it is pornography, then you have all kinds of options of restricting it. It's no longer protected under the full level of free speech.
What's acceptable in the community?
According to the courts, I'll know it when I see it.
That's correct.
So Lon, do you think this is going to lead to like a internet red light district?
No, and mainly because the internet is impossible to regulate. You could have one country decide that that's where their porn should go, but another nation might not have the same desire to do that. I don't think there's anything in the United States we could do to force people to give up their domain names and move over to a XXX domain because of the content type that they offer. Just, I don't think it would fly constitutionally. I think it'll be helpful for some sites who want.
Well, but
the
I think the argument I mean, here's the argument though mm-hmm. is that yep. in the same way that we have red light districts, mm-hmm. one of the things about in our country is that as soon as we define this as pornography, as a specialized piece that you know, we do have a lot of ability to regulate it. You know, we can decide where in a city that occurs. Mm-hmm. We can decide, where that process, it's as soon as you move into that mark of pornography, it has in the past been something that we can actually legislate against. And it's the hard part is that it's really complicated for it's really hard for a representative to vote to allow pornography.
Right.
That's the heart, what they're afraid of, what the industry is afraid of course, is that a Republican leading House of representatives will immediately create a law. You know, they'll wait until this is all kind of sorting out, and then they're going to create a law that says basically, we will fine you if you do not, you know, or we'll shut you down or whatever if you do not use .xxx, you know, in your URL. You know, and that's, I think that, you know, and of course people are wondering, well, why does that matter? Why does it matter to use an XXX? Well, .xxx would make it easier than any other time for anybody to filter it. You know, like right now, people have to go into the content, and there's people that are looking for it and everything else. But if you just required everybody to use .xxx, what it means is that ISPs could create a very easy-to-use service. Apple could create something in Safari. You know, all kinds of other stuff that where it just totally blocks it. Companies can just block it without a lot of without much work at all. So it makes it much easier for people who don't want to see it to block it. And the question is this is a question for Tim, should we be able to do that? Should the people who want to see porn go see porn, and the people who don't want their kids or their employees or whatever going to it, should they be able to block it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you should be able to unplug your computer when you want to.
But should people be able to have that easy control over you know, what's going through their system? I mean, because I can see a possibility of, you know, ISPs just creating a service that basically is, I mean, I can see ISPs building an entire service around the idea that, you know, we, and they already are ISPs that do this, but that, you know, that we will be able to just block all the .xxx stuff when you sign up, so that there's just no way your house could, you know, no way your house could get that.
I think that's a great service to have, and you know, if people want it, they should be able to buy it. Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's the complex part is, you know, for a guy who likes it to tell his wife why he doesn't want to, you know, take that service.
Well,
that's the complexity. No, but that's the complexity. That's what the porn industry is worried about, because there's a lot of guys that go to it that don't want their, you know, don't want to make a big deal about it, and that's the and that's a big part of their business. And I think that's their, you know, I think that is you know, their concern. I personally think it's a great idea.
I bet there are a lot of wives that go shopping and do shopping
exactly
that they don't want their husbands to know about, and so there's a whole other service there.
The credit card that can't be used at certain stores. All right, so anyway, so we'll see how that goes. Now, speaking of viral videos, there's a great, I don't know, somehow we talked about the New York Times at the beginning, and we're three articles in, and we're already still talking about the New York Times. But this is according to the New York Times. This is talking about viral videos catch on, you know, and it's talking about the growth of viral videos. Now, this is something that's a little old hat for us. We've been talking about this for quite some time. But one of the things that they, you know, it's a great article, you know, talking about everything from Old Spice commercials to some of the commercials where people are, you know, creating something. This is one of the videos they were talking about was by BitCrash44, and it was basically a guy changing a bunch of using an electronic device hack to hack into multitude jumbo screens on Times Square and play videos from his iPhone. And of course, I even saw that go by on Twitter. People were, you know, posting this to Twitter. They had, I think they're over a million views now. You know, there were a lot of people who were, you know, who were watching this. It turns out, of course, it was a fake. You know, so it was not the real thing. Now, I think that this was based on the Gizmodo prank that was done at, I believe, CES a couple years ago. That was actually real, but I think this one, they just simply replaced the screens. But anyway, so the question is that it got out there, and it was basically a design to promote the soon to be released Limitless or actually now released Limitless movie. So there's a lot of this viral video, you know, people producing these viral videos and trying to get out there. One of the things it talks a lot about is using just a hint of whatever you're trying to promote, rather than make it something, you know, in your face, the way we normally see marketing. Tim, is this a trend that could really, you know, change everything? I mean, is this something that everyone could be kind of getting a hold of, or does it only work for certain outlets?
Well, I think with this particular case, it's a novelty. I mean, it was interesting, it was great, but it didn't do anything to emotionally engage you in the actual story of Limitless. It didn't. It created questions, but there was no payoff if you went to see the film. And I think that's where this particular viral video fell short. I mean, it did get people talking about it. Is it real? Is it not real? But it did nothing to advance the story or engage an audience in that story.
What would be better? What would they? What would be a great viral video that would engage people in?
Well, if you took the same situation and this guy could hack monitors anywhere and put whatever's on there, whatever he wanted, and then you went to see a film that was about a guy who could change the news, who could, you know, alter whatever is on a video screen in front of somebody. That would be kind of interesting. That would be a home run. That would be, you know, the dots would be connected to where you're seeing something that then goes and pays off with the story. I think it did a great job. I've played around a lot with viral videos, and the key elements of creating a viral video, the key ingredients, you know, and just like anything you're going to cook, it depends on who the chef is and how those ingredients are prepared. But you want to have spectacle, you want to have a little bit of story, and you want to move two or more emotions. And this viral video did that. You know, it created questions in the viewers' minds. It had spectacle. It had story. There's this guy walking around with his iPhone. He's got a device. And so it translated well into a viral video. You want to create those things that make people question it and make people want to show it to their friends to answer that question. And this was definitely able to do that. I just don't think it went further. And I think that as viral video campaigns develop, that's something that people need to think more about. How can they connect it and have a bigger payoff and give people a satisfying experience other than, oh yeah, it was just a hoax? You know, it's like the payoff isn't satisfying. And any good story, you give the viewers an ending that is not out of the realm of their imagination, but it's not predictable and it's satisfying.
Right. Lon, how do people take advantage of this kind of success and create businesses around it?
Well, I think if you and there are businesses now that do these videos, not all of them are successful, but I think there's a real science to getting these things germinated out there to get them spread to the point that you can start hitting an 800,000 view or a million plus view audience for it. And I agree with Tim too that having a better connection between what it is you're trying to virally promote is important. I think there's a fine line between being outwardly promotional and being entertaining while providing that promotional message is probably where the critical component of this lies. And sometimes you can do a commercial like the Old Spice guy did. It was brilliant. It was blatant in your face, but it was so cool that I watched it, and my wife was asking me how come I don't smell like that guy. And I think it varies based on what it is. Sci-fi movies are a great way to do this kind of stuff, especially given, if you have any kind of decent special effects company, you could really do some cool stuff. One thing that is worth looking at, I don't know where this came from or whether this was a viral campaign that failed, but there was this big hubbub online about a year, 2 years, 3 years ago for this UFO drone thing where these pictures of these really realistic looking UFO drones that were appearing over power lines and some other places. It got such a stir that people actually raised money and hired a private investigator to go try to get to the bottom of this thing. It created so much buzz and really well done. There were so many little added bonuses, like a secret document from a research institute and all this crazy stuff, but there was never a connection drawn between who made it and how it all came together. It's just something to keep in mind that just promote what you're trying to promote too.
So no one knows if it was promoting anything.
Yeah, right. I mean, there was all the suspicion. Well, maybe it's for the Transformer movie or maybe it's for this, but nothing ever came together. And then the Terminator show that was, the Terminator show that was on Fox actually did a whole storyline around this whole drone thing, but that was 2.5 years later.
Right.
But there was so much generated out of it. And I was following it just because it was so fascinating and so well produced.
It seems like one of the challenges, this gets back into creating great movies or great anything, is that one of the things about this is that a lot of the stuff we do for corporate or web or promotion, you're looking for a model. Like, how do we do this and then how do we replicate it? And it seems like just like a hit movie or anything else, the challenge is that the mix is so complex, mm-hmm. Of the right all the elements have to be just perfect to get a real viral video to go viral, you know. And it's not something that is just something you can, you know, there's not a math to it to the same level as there is with, you know, with a lot of other marketing. And I think that's one of the difficult things for marketing companies is they just, you know, you really have to think up something totally original. It can't be like any of the other viral ones, you know, and that's going to be, I think, one of the complexities, you know, for that process. So we'll see how that goes. Now we have a best-selling author. This is Barry Eisler, who is, he has already, you know, he's already done pretty well. He's been a best-selling author of a variety of thrillers. This is according to Tech Dirt. And he has turned down, his next book is coming up, he's turned down $500,000 and 14.9% royalties, you know, because he's decided he'd rather have, distribute it himself, distribute his own book electronically, and get no money up front with 70% royalties. Now, what, of course, the math of that is that he has to pretty much sell about four times as many books, you know, than he would have gotten at that 14.9%. So he has to do 4.5 times better than his bookseller would have he needs to sell to get the get to $500,000. And then after that, he's making bank. So he's doing much better. Now, the Tim, does this really allow digital distribution to, does digital distribution allow the big authors to just cut out the middleman, which is the publishers in this case?
Well, you know, it's not just cutting out the middleman that is important to some people. You don't have to sign digital copies. You know, you don't have to do a book signing of digital copies. So it saves your wrist a lot.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, you know, workers' comp is covered, right?
As a creative person, you want to create something, you want to post it, and you want to get paid. You don't want to have to deal with the studio. You don't want to have to deal with a network.
But doesn't the studio and the network? I mean, doesn't the issue is that sometimes that process hone your work so that
absolutely. If you have someone that can be your book editor or someone that can be a creative director that doesn't know the story, that isn't living it, that can give you, you know, you can use as a sounding board, that's extremely valuable. But if you want creative freedom, you know, when you're painting a painting, you don't have anyone giving you notes. You're doing it the way that you want to do it. And for a lot of people, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for that. And I agree with you. Sometimes a studio or a network does hone it, does make it better because of that pushback, and you get a better product. But a lot of times you don't. Right. And is it worth making $100,000 and getting it to do the way you want to do it, as opposed to having to do it the way that your publisher wants you to do it? And I think that's a question for a lot of people to ask. In terms of the big authors, yeah, you know, you look at a Stephen King, they can self-publish something, get it out there, and not have to do that much press. I mean, the great thing about the iTunes store is that they will promote it for you, and they don't charge you money. They just take the 30%. So,
and of course, they want to see these big authors, you know, especially things like iTunes or iTunes exclusives.
Yeah.
You know, Lon, is there a reason to use a publisher, or is this really the future of, do publishers end up just being farm teams before these authors get big?
I think that that's a big part of it, that these publishers do get people famous, right? And as do the music publishers and the broadcast television industry, you know, all these mass audience, highly marketable kind of firms who can market things very well, build up these authors as a brand. And I think it's a big problem for publishers down the road, because once you get to that level of a superstar author, you don't really need them anymore, because you have a fan base, you have a website, you have a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and all that good stuff. And I think this author is going to do more than $500,000 self-publishing, no question about it.
Can you go backwards and start building that audience so that when you're ready to go, so, you know, write short stories or write other things and get a blog, you know, a podcast, Twitter feeds, and get that following before you even release a book?
I think so, and I think this is a great opportunity for people looking for a niche in new media to really service authors looking for that. Because that's something that I think a lot of good authors who really just want to focus on the writing are going to need help with. is developing that online branding and developing that direct relationship with their audience. And that to me sounds like a great business model for some of our listeners to think about.
So we'll see how that goes. Now, CNN now has a new digital playground. They were showing some of this actually at South by Southwest. This is basically a TV everywhere kind of thing where you can see it all over. You know, you can see it on your iPad, on your phone, on the web, on the TV. Now, you need to access the stream. Users will need a television subscription to Comcast, Xfinity, Dish, Cox, or Verizon Fios. The initiative arrives at the same time that Time Warner's launching its own iPad app, allowing users to watch 32 live channels. This is according to Fast Company, by the way. CNN has promised virtually indistinguishable quality between mobile and TV streamed content. Lon, is this the convergence that everyone's been talking about?
That's getting there. I mean, if I have to log into it, though, it's going to be a pain in the butt. Right. You know, the notion of TV is that it's very simple. You turn it on and you get a channel. So, you know, I think the mechanics of it will be important to look at. But I think it's also great for new media people like us, because it means that people are going to get more accustomed to consuming their content that way. And my channel is on an iPad right now that people can go and grab. So I think it's good for everybody to get.
Where's your channel, Juan?
Well, we've got a iTunes podcast feed, like everyone does, so you can do that. We've got a little iPhone app that you can use as well, and then, of course, you can just go to the local onlinenews.tv website and view it that way. I think it's good that people are, you know, on these screens already, and if this gets them over there, that's great, because it's definitely, I think, good for us in the end. And the best part is that, you know, all of these networks are going to have a number of restrictions on how they get watched, and you know, that actually will, I think, bridge more content to independent providers.
Now they're starting off with these television requirements for television subscription. But Tim, should the cable providers be concerned about this, about the trajectory of this?
Well, they're involved in this. I mean, if you have an iPad right now and you go to CNN.com or you go to other cable type sites, you see a varying degree of what videos you can watch and how you can watch them. If you try to watch CNN using AirPlay on your Apple TV, you'll get the audio from CNN, but you won't get the video. If you hook up a cable to your iPad 2 and watch it RGB on your TV, you get the video, but not the audio. So they're restricting it in different ways. But with the Xfinity, with Dish, they've made deals with the cable providers, with the satellite providers, to get that same experience through them, and you have to be a subscriber. So, you know, you take a look at these companies that are making billions of dollars a year in licensing fees from cable companies. They don't want to lose that revenue. They don't want to upset that apple cart. So they have to figure out a way to give people what they want when they want it, but give it to them a way that doesn't erode their current business model.
And do it slow enough that they don't, that they're, you know, that they can kind of figure it out, the trajectory as it's going.
Yeah, they don't want to turn into Blockbuster. I mean, who would have thought that Netflix was going to, you know, be the demise of Blockbuster? But it seems that way. So, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, we're, you know, I was at this announcement, and the question that I couldn't get close enough to the guy doing the demo, I didn't get a chance to ask him, but I wanted to ask about the ad insertion, because it's one thing to get the subscriber money. It's another thing, you know, in cable TV, you still have those ads. And with these connected devices, this is the holy grail of cable. They've always wanted to have an addressable device that they would know who the consumer is, that they can deliver tailored advertising. And if they're just doing a retransmission of their cable feed, they lose that. Right. So this is a great opportunity now for, you know, once this is in place, is for them to do a like-for-like video ad insertion on these connected devices, and to be able to deliver that in-stream video advertising to an addressable device that's geo-targeted, geo-aware, and to be able to tailor those spots to the individual. I think it's, from an advertising standpoint, I think it's a pretty exciting time.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I think it's, I think that that is the key, is being able to really, there's so many tie-ins and so much stuff that you could be doing. And I spend so much time watching I find myself watching the TV with my iPad open. And a lot of times I'm searching about things that I saw on the TV. sometimes it's like, who is that actress or who is that actor or who or what movie was that in or what, you know, a lot of times that's the case. Or if I see something in the news, I suddenly find myself, you know, searching and everything else. And there's no, that's not really tied in very well currently, but it looks like we're on our way.
The coolest thing is to be on an iPad 2, be searching for some content, and then hit the AirPlay button and be able to watch it on your TV. Yeah. I mean, that is just so much fun to do. I wish I could do it with every video that I come across on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's the AirPlay is turning into quite a thing. I've been looking at getting like an AirPort or a Apple TV 2. We have two of them here in the house for the two different TVs, and it's just incredible because they're all hooked to a media server, then they're hooked to the internet. And have you guys noticed that there was an update, and now you can watch Major League Baseball and NBA stuff through the Apple TV. So getting that live stuff is starting to kind of, you know, get in. But what we're looking at is actually just using it when you walk into our offices and you see just, you know, we can play videos and we can play, you know, stills of our behind the scenes and, you know, a lot of the other stuff. And it's just and then we can be talking to a client and immediately AirPlay something from our iPhone or iPad to the screen without having to, it's not a lot of let's hook this up or let me show, you know, it's just boom, it's there. So it's quite a thing. So anyway, so last story of today, Groupon goes to the movies. This is a Lionsgate deal, and this is according to ChicagoBusiness.com. Chicago-based online coupon dealer on Wednesday began selling discount tickets to the Lincoln Lawyer. This is the new Matthew McConaughey vehicle with Marissa Tomei and Ryan. Is it Philippe? Is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah. And it's a two-day deal where tickets are $6 each, and it was put together by Groupon and Lionsgate. And so as of Wednesday afternoon, this was last week, they had sold 5,000 tickets in Chicago, New York, and in Washington, D.C. So is this the future? Is Groupon taking over the movie industry, Lon?
I think it's another ingenious way to sell movie tickets, and it might supplement some of their other things. And the best part about it is that if you prepay, you're committed, right? Because yeah, you're either out the $12 or you're going. I wonder if the no-shows are going to count towards the box office totals. I'm not sure how they go about calculating all that. But,
well, it is, because it's just it's income.
Yeah, it's income for the movie. So I guess it does. It's a great idea. I think Groupon in of itself gets a lot of traffic. So even if people don't jump on the deal itself, they're still seeing the marketing for it. So I'm sure they could put a trailer up there and do some other things to promote the film. So it's not a bad idea. And, you know, $6 isn't a bad price, but it's certainly still not cheap to go to a movie, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it'll work, I think. I mean, it's Groupon's been doing some neat stuff like this, and that prepay is a valuable thing, especially to people that rely on the revenue stream.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting. The interesting thing is that there's a risk here of both, prepay and not going, and then they get money for it whether you win or not. So that's right. A good side of it. But the other side of it, of course, is they're giving up a certain amount of income. I mean, I don't know what it costs in some of these locations, but I know that in San Francisco, $6 is less than the matinee.
so Tim, that's a good deal then out there, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. $6 is a very good deal in San Francisco. Tim, is this? Do you think that we're going to see this with lots and lots of movies?
Well, you know, you look at the movie business, and it's a lot like the restaurant business. If you don't fill that seat, it's gone forever. You don't still have it available on a shelf. It's available at a specific time in a specific place.
Well, in a lot of ways, you've coordinated your efforts for that first weekend. Like, everything is all pushed to get as many, you know, get as much money in. Because a lot of it is also, you know, you have a, if a movie doesn't go well the first week, the press is bad, it's a failure. We saw this with Mars Needs Moms, where it doesn't matter how good the movie is or how bad the movie is. They spent $150 million on the movie and they made $8 million the first week, and everyone has, you know, now no one's going to go see it until it comes out on DVD.
Yeah, they should have changed the title of that one. I think would have helped it a lot. Yeah. I think it's a way to get people in and fill those seats and make sure, especially with, you know, I don't think Lincoln Lawyer stacked up as well as Limitless. I didn't look at the box office this week, but you have to do your best to get that thing rocking and rolling on the first weekend.
So very good. Lon, where can people find you?
People can find me at lonseidman.com, lonseidman.com, and all my projects are on there. I'm actually going back to NASA, Alex. I got going to be helping out a local independent Connecticut news source to document some of the aerospace industry in Connecticut's contribution to NASA. So I'll be heading out for Endeavor's launch, which is really exciting to go see another one. So I'll have some stuff on there, and localonlinenews.tv is where our hyperlocal video is living these days.
Fantastic. And Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at mdialogue.com or onetimstreet.com. I'm also going to be at NAB. So
we're going to drag you up on stage.
Yeah, if you're going to be at NAB, you know, shoot me an email, tim@mdialogue.com, and maybe we can meet up, have a drink, coffee, and chat about video ad insertion for TV everywhere.
We should do some kind of tweet up.
That'd be great.
Yeah, so let's think about a night that we can do that.
Very good.
Awesome. All right. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.